World War One troops were the first to be diagnosed with a new condition, shell shock. In Dublin, the unique and groundbreaking initiative to treat these traumatised soldiers took place at the Richmond War Hospital. This was a small specialist psychiatric hospital located on the grounds of the Richmond District Asylum at Grange Gorman. Descriptions of patients from the War Hospital archives offer an insight into the minds of those who had gone through a traumatic war experience.
In October 1918, a 23-year-old Catholic captain was admitted to Richmond War Hospital owing to the
hardships of war
and
being buried by shellfire.
The admitting officer noted that he
seems rather weak and emotional, tongue tremulous, fine tremor of limbs.
Mentally, he was
dull, depressed and confused, replies more by motion of his head.
Case history, driver AB. He is so confused, he does not realise where he is and speaks at times as if he believed he was in France.
He was blown up by a shell behind the lines. He seems rather nervous and apprehensive.
When questioned more closely, he asked,
"The guns are coming out, aren't they? Aren't they coming up for a rest?"
When he drops off to sleep, he wakes up in a fright and fancies someone is beside his bed.
He states he hears everyone talking about him, but cannot tell what they say.
He complains of some pain in his head and loss of memory.
When questioned if he were in France, he said,
"Yes."
And then,
"No, I remember now. I'm in Ireland, aren't I? I think I am."
A collection of excerpts from the Richmond War Hospital archives where 362 soldiers with nervous and mental troubles were treated. My guests are historians Edward Madigan and Pádraig Gates and psychiatrist Brendan Kelly. And Brendan, you've been examining those War Hospital patient files, 362 of them. Shell shock, is it what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder? Is it as simple as that?
It's very similar to what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And certainly if we were to try to apply today's diagnostic categories to these soldiers, we would come up with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. At the time, though, matters were considerably less clear. There was an article in The Lancet in February 1915, which probably provided the first clear description of shell shock and highlighted symptoms like anxiety, fatigue, pain and headache, but also what we now call re-experiencing, which is having flashbacks, having nightmares, having dreams, or being uncertain where you are or what's going on. And this was clearly more common in soldiers who had been directly exposed to shellfire and had been sent back as a result.
There was shellfire in Crimea, there was shellfire in the Boer War, in the Napoleonic Wars. Why was this not recognised as a syndrome or a condition or a disorder before World War One?
Well, when you look retrospectively at the records of soldiers who left the army during those other conflicts, you find evidence of nervous or psychological problems which were otherwise diagnosed. For example, disordered action of the heart was a diagnosis. And there was a series of remarkable diagnostic categories. There was something called circulatory asthenia that was common in US soldiers, effort syndrome, irritable heart of soldiers, nostalgia neurasthenia and psychogenic rheumatism. Now, all of these map onto what would later be known as shell shock,
right,
because the medical system was really struggling to come to terms with how best to describe and treat these soldiers. Matters really reached a head, though, with the First World War, when over a 6-month period in 1916, the British Army alone recorded some 16,000 cases of what appeared to be what was soon called shell shock. So this was an extraordinary number of soldiers having to leave the front, clearly unable to function.
And I'm sure they were very pleased at that. Tell me about some of the stories that particularly struck you in the files of these soldiers.
Well, the files are quite diverse and quite interesting. But for example, a gunner in the army, Gunner G.H., let us call him, was aged 38. He joined the army in 1914, went to the front in 1916. In 1918, he returned and was admitted to the Richmond War Hospital. He was dull, depressed and worried. He had pain and bursting noises in his head. When he drops off to sleep, he wakes up in a fright and fancies someone is about his bed. In his dreams, he imagines he is running. Private JK, a 19-year-old who had been in the army for a year and a half. He was admitted in 1918. He had joined the army in 1917. He spent 5 months at the front, but he was blown up and buried for 36 hours near Kemmel in Belgium. And as a result, he got what appeared to be shell shock. He was trembling. He couldn't use his right hand owing to trembling. He had pains in his head, and he was disturbed by dreams whenever he managed to fall asleep. Another man, a gunner, call him Gunner MN, a 35-year-old, arrived with shell shock. He was pale, thin and worn-looking, apathetic. He had insomnia, and he stated that he had lost himself completely in the war.
And was the object of the army in particular to patch him up and get him back as quickly as possible?
There seems to have been a certain acceptance in the military authorities that many of these men would not return to battle. Indeed, the hospital received a letter from the army outlining that these soldiers remained under the command of the army until such time as they were discharged as invalids. There seemed to be little expectation they would return to battle. And indeed, it appears that of the 362 soldiers in the Richmond War Hospital, fewer than 5% went directly back into the army.
What happened the rest of them after the war, do we know?
Well, in the short term, around 2/3 of them were discharged back to family or friends. Under 10% of them were transferred to the regular asylum system, because there is evidence in the file that some of these men had mental illness separate to their wartime experience, perhaps exacerbated by their experiences at war. But, for example, there are records of one soldier who developed a clear paranoid illness, and he presented himself to Dublin Castle saying he was part of the intelligence department and he had been sent by the Lord Lieutenant. Now, closer examination revealed this man was indeed traumatised by war, but it would appear that he had mental illness separate to that, perhaps prior to the war.
And how were these soldiers treated in the Richmond War Hospital? I mean, anybody who's read Pat Barker's Regeneration will be familiar with the kind of treatment that went on in Craig Lockhart in Edinburgh, which was the kind of the talking cure, as opposed to the electric shock treatment. And there's a scene towards the end of the book where it's absolutely hideously described. So what was the norm in Richmond?
Well, the Richmond War Hospital focused on rest and quietude as a form of treatment. And for this kind of disorder, there was a tradition of the rest cure. And indeed, some literature in the UK talks about aggressive rest, which means forcing people to rest. There was a phrase called veranda treatment, where people were put sitting on the veranda for a period of time. So I suppose the good news is that there's no evidence that some of the more intrusive treatments like electric shocks or so forth were used for these soldiers. They used warm and cold baths, giving people a series of baths. They used certain medicines, although sparingly. They used bromides, which worked apparently as sedatives. And they also used caffeine, which the soldiers found helpful. And according to the records, when the mixture was discontinued, the men begged for its repetition.
Interesting, the effects of caffeine.
It shows how the war did affect all sorts of things. But one of the downsides of the, blaming the alienation from British rule in the First World War was that the Irish unions refused to cooperate with the military authorities. There was no cross-fertilisation between, as I understand it, Bernard may correct me on this, but there was no cross-fertilisation between, say, the houses of industry, hospitals, and the military facility that could have been there, because Irish people generally, and the psychiatric nurses in particular, wanted to have absolutely nothing to do with anything to do with the British Army. And it sounds like it was a great lost opportunity to learn things.
So certainly the asylums tended to be very nationalist, and lots of staff members were had difficulties. For example, with the establishment of the Richmond War Hospital, the board, it was brought to the attention of the board that certain staff members were refusing to do duty in the war hospital for reasons that aren't recorded in the records book. And it seems the system tried to work around this. Interestingly, in the Richmond Asylum, the main asylum at the time, there were some very nationalist doctors, including a Dr. Eleonora Fleury at the time, who would later go to prison for harbouring Republicans in St. Edith's Asylum. And she treated various Republicans in her house at the Richmond Asylum as well. And she was incidentally the first female psychiatrist in Ireland or Great Britain. Similarly, in Ballinasloe, you had a Dr. Ada English, who was, you know, very sort of anti-treaty ultimately, but very Republican. And in 1916, Ballinasloe Asylum cut off all communication with the British government in Ireland.
And Brendan's book on the subject, He Lost Himself Completely, Shell Shock and Its Treatment at the Richmond War Hospital, will be out in November. Did these men make recoveries, full recoveries, any way of gauging this?
It's extremely difficult to work out the how well they got on over the years. I mean, there are clear cases of soldiers who did very well. Just as nowadays, there are soldiers who cope extremely well with something that you or I might regard as unimaginable trauma. But it seems more likely that many of these men had recurring problems over the years. And I know there are described cases of World War I veterans who had their post-traumatic stress disorder reawakened vicariously during the Second World War and suffered a relapse of symptoms despite not being directly involved.
Well, I mean, while we're talking about shell shock, I think it's important to remember, and this is something that's impressed me over the years as I've read more about this, is that the men who suffered from debilitating psychological trauma were a minority. I mean, the resilience of the human spirit in the face of adversity really comes out when you read about the experience of, let's say, the Western Front or Gallipoli. But I think for many men who weren't debilitated to the point of having to be sectioned and put in an asylum, you know, they suffered from mood swings, they were vulnerable to alcohol abuse, depression, rage, these sorts of things. But at the same time, men who remembered horror and deprivation also had remembered very positive experiences, camaraderie and fellowship and being part of this great dramatic moment in world history, which they understood at the time. So they had mixed feelings about their war service. Some of them certainly remembered it as the happiest days of their lives.
Comes across in the poetry, comes across in Wilfred Owen, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not relentlessly anti-war, so it's very, very
ambivalent.